You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I'm David Ignatius, a columnist for the Washington Post, and the host of this conversation with Amr Moussa. It's a great pleasure to welcome him here.
Thank you.
As you know, he is Secretary General of the Arab League, has been in that post since 2001. Many of us first met him during his years as Egypt's foreign minister from 1991 to 2001. And he's a person who follows the details and also the broad themes of policy in the Middle East as well as anyone I know. We're going to have a conversation between Amr and me for the first 30 minutes or so, and then we'll turn to you and the audience for your questions. So please be thinking about them. Amr, let me start by asking you about your visit here. I know you've been seeing senior officials in this new administration, and I think we'd all be very interested in your sense of where they are in terms of their policies toward the Middle East and where you think they're going.
Well, thank you very much, David, for your very kind introduction. And I'm very happy to be here in the Carnegie Endowment with this wonderful audience trying to discuss the current issues, especially pertaining to the Middle East. I came a couple of days back, had a very heavy schedule organized by Ambassador Hassouna. Met with some think tanks and some influential groups and also officials, leaving this evening with a feeling of hope that we are embarking, as I believe, on a different period with a different policy. What President Obama used to stress during the campaign about change, I can see that change. What we need in the Middle East is a change in the policy towards playing an honest broker role, a line that totally disappeared in the last 8 years. Hence the failure and the tension and the As you see, the Middle East is not in a good shape because of that. If the U.S. decides, as I hope and I believe, thinking goes in that direction, the honest broker role, the Middle East would be in a better shape and things would fall into place with moving on the question of Arab-Israeli conflict, the question of regional security, the question of future of the Middle East in a more open way and with a lot of hope rather than the depression we all felt in the last several years.
You had a chance to meet recently with President Obama's special emissary, special representative for the Arab-Israeli peace process, the former Senator George Mitchell. Give us your impression of him, because he's going to be a key player, and what you sense is the agenda for him and for the administration over the next few months.
Well, I'll try to indicate in so few words what I feel. Of course, I knew Senator Mitchell in a previous life when he was the representative of President Clinton and prepared his famous report about the Arab-Israeli conflict. I met him again after he accepted this mission. And I would say that Mr. Mitchell, in my opinion, is the personification of honest brokership. I hope that this would be the case all the way through and that he will be supported by policy that would enable him to play that role.
One of the hardest questions when you think about the Palestinian issue, that part of the broad question of the Middle East, is who the parties in negotiation will be in this next phase. And I know one issue that the Arab League has thought a lot about is whether it might be possible to bring together the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and elements of Hamas in some kind of united front, if you will, that might be able to negotiate for a broader constituency of Palestinians. Tell us about that, whether you think it's possible, how you might go about that.
Well, as you know, tomorrow they both Fatah and Hamas are going to resume their talks under the Egyptian mediation. But there is something interesting started happening in the last 3 or 4 weeks, that whenever both the representatives of Hamas and Fatah are in any Arab city, they tend to sit together and talk. Not under, with the presence of any other Arab observer, but they talk to each other. This happened yesterday in Cairo, 2 weeks back in Cairo, and in other places, even in Gaza. So the situation is changing. I'm not claiming that this would be the total conciliation within days, but they are on that track. And both of them know that none of them will be the victor and the other will be vanquished. Both of them are going to lose if they continue this path. So this, perhaps, is one if the, is the main element that has brought them together. Yes, they accepted the mediation. They work, they discuss formally at the table where other Arabs are there, and the, in particular the Egyptian mediators. But they, in the afternoon, they sit together. At night, they sit together. And they talk at a certain level, at a quite high level. So I have also, I am hopeful on this point too. I do not want to leave the audience with a false feeling of optimism that things are going to be, no. But we are on the right track, or about to be on the right track on that point.
An issue that's of great interest and concern here and also in Israel is whether Hamas or some of its leaders are prepared to accept a two-state solution. And there's been considerable discussion and debate about that, about statements that have been made by Khaled Mishal and others. And I'd be interested in your assessment. You read those statements carefully and you talk to all the key people. How should we understand that?
Look, David, you continue to ask us about our opinion or the opinion of this or that Arab party or this or that Arab organization about the two-state solution, while Israel has not accepted the two-state solution. Until now, there is not a single statement, official statement, that Israel accepts the two-state solution and accepts to have a viable Palestinian state and is ready to prepare for that and deal with such or live with such a state. So I have to ask you that question too. Have you heard of the Israelis that they accept the two-state solution and that a viable Palestinian state be created and live with them and they are ready to live with it in security, peace, and cooperation? That is number one. Number two, yes, Hamas accepts the notion of two states. And Mashal has said that more than once, that they are ready to accept it. Some conditions were put, but the essence was said. The essence was said by them. So, if the Israelis are serious, and we are not sure that they are serious, I believe all Arabs, all Palestinian factions, all Palestinian sides will accept that two-state solution.
Before I leave the question of this new administration, I want to ask you about perceptions in the Arab world. The Arab world certainly was eager to see a change in U.S. policy, but give us a sense of how President Obama is perceived in the countries that make up the Arab League.
We're all well-disposed to help President Obama. We're all happy that he won the elections. What we have heard of him, especially his call for change, serious change in the American policy, sends the right message. So we're all ears, all the antennas are raised We're waiting.
Administrations, as you know, have a tendency to, as we would say, reinvent the wheel when it comes to Middle East diplomacy. We have, in the very recent past, a serious effort to talk between Israelis and Palestinians about the key issues in what we call the Annapolis process, which began with a gathering of all of the key Arab states in support. And I wonder whether you think that there are elements of that process of dialogue that can be used going forward as a basis, or whether, in fact, it's wise for this new administration and George Mitchell to, in fact, start over again.
No, it's not a question of start over again, but to start on the right foot, with the right foot, on the right track. They don't have to reinvent the wheel, but there was no wheel for the last 7 years or 8 years. There was no wheel. And the Annapolis has failed. We cannot build on Annapolis, and we should not build on Annapolis. In Annapolis, and before going there, we agreed, we reached some understandings that negotiations should not be conducted while the territory is being settled, building settlements in the territories, which change the demographic composition by the day, which changes the geographical character by the day. I even told Condoleezza Rice and others, and Tony Blair, and Solana, together, just imagine that the Palestinians and the Israelis are negotiating, and today is Wednesday, and agreed to meet again next Monday. The map on which they base their discussions today has to change next Monday, because it is not the same with the settlements, with the settlers, etc. So settlements have to stop, and this was one the main understanding. We were promised that yes, indeed, we'll work for that. We cannot negotiate while the settlements are being built. One. Two, we said that we made a mistake all through the 90s, that we accepted a peace process, an open-ended peace process. No time frame, just talk. And then come tomorrow or next year or in a couple of years and continue your talk. There was no time frame at all. So we demanded, and I stressed that there must be a time frame. Answer, of course, the president promises that by the end of 08, there will be a Palestinian state next to the Israeli state. So we consider this 2008 as the time frame for the Annapolis process. Number three, that conferences or meetings to supervise, to analyze the progress that has been made, to take stock with the developments, will have to be convened, preferably the United under the UN auspices. But at that time, Moscow offered to host the next meeting. We were in November 07, that it would be April, May 08. So giving 6 months or 7 months for the negotiations to produce something. Of course, the negotiations produced absolutely nothing. Not only so, if and when Mr. Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, is here in Washington, I suggest that Carnegie Endowment invites him and ask him about the process of negotiations. Because he told us formally that, yes, we went and talked. And when I talk about Jerusalem, Abbas talks about Jerusalem, I didn't find Olmert leaving the room. But when Olmert say, you see, this is a good point, and I ask him, why don't we put something in writing that we discuss this issue and that issue and we reach this or that agreement or this agreement, said no, we just chat, we just talk. And that's how the year 2008 was spent, just talk in this room and change on in the occupied territories day by day, removing a village, building a settlement, expelling people, bringing in some of the settlers and so on. So you cannot build on that. And I don't think we are ready to enter into another peace process the way it was projected and it was done. It was a process aimed at procrastination, delays, and giving time to the Israeli government to settle the occupied territories. This should not be repeated. Should not be repeated. Here I come to the what you said, that we should not reinvent the wheel. The wheel is there since quite some time. Each and every point, Jerusalem, borders, state, refugees, water, we have in our drawers more than 2 to 3 alternatives for each point. You don't have to start again. What you have to probe is whether the Israeli government has the courage to produce the political will and sovereign decision to announce to us all that, yes, I am ready for peace. For us, if you ask me, what have you done, you Arabs? I said, yes, we have done a lot. We have our initiative, asking or inviting, offering the Israelis recognition by the 22 countries members of the Arab League, normalization of relations, an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict, a new page. This is written. This is what, just read the Arab Initiative, and you'll find that it is an offer that Israel shouldn't have refused. But there is an obstacle. The Israelis do not want a state, a Palestinian state. And we have doubts whether they want peace, a fair peace or not. Do they need a fair peace? They have an initiative, Arab Initiative, telling them we are ready for peace. We are ready to recognize you, open our doors and windows, end the state of animosity. No state of war, but state of friendship and cooperation. Why didn't they pick it up? Why? Some say because they don't want that. They don't want this kind of peace that would have a Palestinian state next door. But some say because they have total protection by the American diplomacy, as was the case in the last few years. We went to the International Court of Justice, which is one of the main tenets of the international system, on the question of the wall. We came back with a unanimous advisory opinion by the court that the wall is unlawful, and building settlements is a violation of the 4th Geneva Convention and the international humanitarian law. So we brought this opinion to the General Assembly to approve it according to the procedures. We had a vast majority, over 160 countries, saying, yes, of course, we have to respect it, with 2 votes against. So Israel feels that they enjoy immunity against international law. So why should they bother? Why should they concede? Why should they allow a Palestinian state to be established? Hence the change in the American policy towards honest brokership. It says to Israel, yes, you have those rights. You have to live in peace and security. This is your right. But the Palestinians must have their state. And the questions of security will be dealt with according to this plan 1, 2, 3, 4. To continue such a policy, giving Israel everything, immunity against international law, this, it never happens. It never happened in the history of the world. So we are at this stage now. We do hope that the Israelis will turn and accept our offer or tell us about their offer. Not to keep silent and look the other way whenever somebody talks to them about peace.
Let me ask you before we leave this subject, whether in your conversations with U.S. officials you've had any specific assurance or statement that the U.S. will pursue a different policy on, for example, a settlements freeze. That's one of the elements that you have mentioned. It's often one of the ways that we measure the U.S. Role. Have you heard anything specifically,
David,
on that subject?
David, I am representing the Arab side, and I talk on behalf of the Arab side. I cannot talk to the on behalf of the administration. You will have ample time to ask any of them. But it is only reasonable that any reasonable man or woman would say, yes, settlements have to stop.
Okay. Let me turn to a different part of the peace process, if you will, and that's the Syria track. We've had indirect negotiations going on between Syria and Israel through Turkish mediation publicly since April, May of last year. When I talked to President Bashar Assad in Damascus in December, before the Gaza war, he said to me, as he said to many visitors, that he's prepared to move to direct negotiations if the United States will join this process as a sponsor and co-guarantor. And so I want to ask you how we should think about this Syria track. You're in touch with all the parties. Is it your sense that this is ripe now, that this is an area where movement by this administration to support, co-sponsor this process will bear fruit?
First, let us commend the efforts of your and my friend Recep Tayyip Erdogan on this issue. You agree?
I have said so publicly often and would say so again.
No, he's a great man, no question about that. And the contribution by Turkey on this track is important. And I believe, yes, this is the time to pick this issue, not at the expense of any other track, but it is time. It is high time for all of us to push for a comprehensive approach. Let the Syrians negotiate with the Israelis under the American auspices and the Turkish auspices too. And the Palestinians would do the same. You remember the Madrid formula. At a certain moment, four tracks worked at the same time. The Syrian, the Palestinian, the Jordanian, and Lebanese. So why not two or three work at the same time? It is high time. It is necessary. And I would encourage the American administration, and I do that, to push forward with the Syrian track together with the Palestinian track.
One of the things that President Assad told me was that he would encourage two other sets of negotiations, one involving Lebanon and Israel, and one involving the Palestinians, but by implication, drawing Hamas or its representatives into that process. Let me focus on the role of Lebanon, a member of the Arab League, obviously. And what's interesting about President Assad's proposal is that Hezbollah and its representatives are part of the Lebanese government, so that any negotiation between Lebanon and Israel, by definition, would involve at least indirect participation, implicit participation by Hezbollah.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a promising way forward? This is one of the trickiest issues of all.
No, I agree with what President Assad has told you. Also, the Lebanese track will have to be tackled at the same time. If we aim at a comprehensive peace.
You've spent a lot of your time over the last few years trying to seek a stable political situation in Lebanon. The Arab League mediation has been often a part of this process, working with Prime Minister Siniora and others. Tell us, after the Doha summit and the Doha agreement on Lebanon, what do you think about the situation that has emerged? Does it seem to you to be stable? Does it seem to you to be a good pathway to the elections? What concerns you, if anything?
I believe we succeeded in moving the Lebanese situation from total confrontation on almost everything to a situation of consensus, electing a president, revitalizing the parliament, the government of national unity, including Hezbollah and all others, sit together in the Council of Ministers. The army is trying to refurbish its ranks. The head of the army is here in Washington nowadays. Yes, we moved. The situation in Lebanon really moved towards a better situation altogether, but it is still fragile. The point is that the situation is still fragile. The next few months are crucial because elections are supposed to be held, scheduled to be held in June. So we have from now until June. The Lebanese know that this is the last chance. If they miss it, I'm afraid that Lebanon will disintegrate. But now they are on the right track, and I don't think they're going to miss this opportunity. I believe they are going to build on it. But some powers are called upon to keep away, to keep their hands off the situation in Lebanon.
Would you like to specify which powers you're thinking about?
Have I said something like that?
Let me turn to another fragile political situation beset by confessional sectarian divisions, and that's Iraq. The Obama administration is going to announce shortly its plan for Iraq, and essentially that's going to be the timetable for the withdrawal of American troops.
Yeah.
And this process that we have imagined, talked about, fought about, is finally now going to come to pass with a date set for the withdrawal of our forces. That raises a question about the stability of one of your, I believe, founding Arab League members, the nation of Iraq, still fragile, and probably even more so in this period of drawdown of American troops. And I want to ask you about how you think stability can be maintained in this Iraq that has so many divisions, and what specifically the Arab states can do to support this new government, a government of Prime Minister Maliki that, frankly, some Arab states have been very wary about, very suspicious about.
Iraq had two major problems since the invasion, 2003. The invasion in itself and the Pandora's box that has been opened, and the sectarian and geographical, religious, cultural conflicts started to prevail in Iraq. Those two dangers contributed to the destabilization of Iraq, to the point that many people at that time spoke of the partition of Iraq, that Iraq will never be one again. The Kurdistan will go its way, Shiastan will go its way, and the center of Sunnah will go its way. You know, of course, that the main intervention at that time was by the Arab League. We insisted that the most important thing now is not to talk about the withdrawal of American troops, but to talk about the re-establishment of Iraq and the national unity of Iraq based on the citizenship that you are Iraqi, therefore you must have all your rights and your obligations to respect your obligations, on the fact that you are Iraqi, not because you are Muslim or Christian, not because you are Shia or Sunnah, not because you are an Arab or Kurd. And we call that a reconciliation process. We brought them in Cairo in the Arab League in November 2005, after a lot of work has been done. And all of them, all those people that you read their names today, they were there, including al-Maliki. The Sunnah, the Shia, the Kurds, you name it, the Turkmen, everybody. And the paper was achieved. They signed the paper, stressing the fact that they understand and appreciate the fact that their division will kill Iraq, will destroy Iraq. And I told them that America or any other foreign power will have to leave, if not today, then tomorrow. If not this year, then next year. But you are going to be divided, you will kill each other, and your stronger neighbors will come and just get whatever they want to get out of you. Now, the talk in Iraq is about that. It's about a national unity, a national army, a national police force, a national judiciary, a national this and that. And they started to get in, Kurds, Shia, Sunni started. It's not perfect yet. But this is the path. Once they did that, which is what they did. In fact, they did start. You can start talking about the withdrawal of the U.S. So this is the right time. Let the Iraqis move on the path of national unity, and let the American forces move on the path of going out. This is the time.
Let me ask you one final question before I turn to the audience for your questions, and that's about what's probably the biggest foreign policy issue, at least in the Middle East, that confronts this administration now, and that's Iran. The administration is conducting a review of Iran policy. This is an administration that loves strategic reviews, we've discovered. They have one on just about every subject, but one of the most important is about Iran. This is an issue of great importance, and I would say of concern to your members. When administration officials travel in the Middle East, they tell me one of the first things they hear on every stop in the Arab world is concern about Iran, concern about U.S. policy, and I would say concern that the U.S. will move too quickly to fulfill President Obama's promise during the campaign that he wants to engage Iran. There are worries that that engagement could make things worse, more unstable than they are. I'd be very interested, I'm sure our audience would be, in how you think about the question of the U.S. engagement with Iran and the larger question of how to bring Iran into a stable framework for security in this region.
First, let me tell you the other side of the coin. In the last few years, in all stations, all capitals, the issue of Iran was raised by the visitors rather than by the resident governments. What about Iran? What are we going to do with Iran? Iran is extreme danger, etc. Some of the immediate neighbors of Iran feel that, a huge country versus small countries. One. Two, there are problems, like the dispute on the Arab islands, Emirates islands, between and the claim of Iran. Very recently, they talked about Bahrain also, and some negative statements were uttered by some Iranian officials about the Persian nature. The question of the nuclear program, the ambitions, regional ambitions, etc. Against this background, I would tell you the following. A, there is nothing wrong that any country be ambitious, provided that this be done in a way that would accept the competition of others also for ambitions. Number two, that they should accept that the Arab world, this is an Arab region, and nothing could be done, decided, in the absence of or without the approval of the Arab countries, the Arab group of nations, the Arab League. Number three, that the Middle East, in our opinion, the Middle East does not need any military nuclear program. We don't need it. But when we say so, this applies to Iran as it applies to Israel. And applies to any X or Y or Z. Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Algeria or Morocco, this applies to everybody. We don't see, we cannot comprehend, we cannot absorb what we were told, that the Iranian program is dangerous, the Israeli program is not. This program is nice, this program is bad. We couldn't accept that. That hence came the failure of that policy. We were not convinced. Why do you tell me that there is a good program, nuclear program, and a bad nuclear program? And who is judge for that? And according to whose interests you are talking about? Indeed, we do not need any military program, Iranian or otherwise. But when we come down to work, we'll have to deal with the region. In addition to the fact that until now, not a single report by the IAEA has told us, for sure, in a definite language, that now the IAEA has determined that Iran is following a military path. They have not said so. In the absence of such a determination, why should we go that far to believe what certain propaganda is trying to convince everybody, save us, Iran is about to produce a bomb. The IAEA does not and did not say so. They hinted. They stressed the fact that, yes, the Iranians are moving in that direction. but Israel is already there in that destination. So the best thing is for the Middle East to be a zone free from all nuclear weapons. If the American diplomacy, international diplomacy can help us, this will deal with all the dangers, present and future. Because I want to assure you that if Israel and Iran prove to have such programs, Egypt will not stay put or tight. And for that matter, Saudi Arabia or Algeria or you or Syria, and you name it. So this is a dangerous path, not the Iranian path per se, but the policy gimmicks played to play up a program and down another program. And we are not stupid. We know what is going on. So I don't think we shall reconcile to a policy that would say accept this because it is danger in our opinion, or is danger because Israel says so, but the other one is not that dangerous. No, we don't believe in that. We won't accept it.
And
Finally, a moment, David. Finally, Iran is a country in the region. They are not going to leave. They are not going to travel. So we'll have to find a modus vivendi together, the Iranians and the Arabs. Everybody else will come and go. Will come and go. So we'll have to establish a policy, a sound policy, based on non-nuclear weapons allowed in this region, based on a sound regional security scheme, based on the solution of the problems, major problems like the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is the mother of all conflicts and all mistrust and all anger and all...
Let me take this as the moment to turn to the audience. If you could please identify yourselves as you pose your question to Secretary General Musa, and please keep the questions short because we have a lot of hands raised. Yes, please.
When the decision came about a few months ago of Ocampo on the issue of Sudan and the conflicts in Darfur, we've seen a lot of movements by the Arab League, including a trip to Khartoum by yourself, Secretary, talking about a plan to solve the issue in Darfur. Nothing has come out since, and now we are awaiting a declaration by the International Court on March 4th. How does the Arab League see this process, especially since we have been hearing now that there is a politicization?
There's a what?
A politicization of the issue.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not true because given the fact that Darfurians have been there in camps since 2003-2004.
Thank you. This requires a long answer, but I will try to be as brief as I can. Since the announcement by Ocampo of his accusations, his application, I got in touch with him, and we know each other well from the UN days. I told him, look, the situation in Darfur is bad already. Can you safely and soundly say that the responsibility only falls on the shoulders of one side? Or whatever crimes that have been committed and are being committed are committed by all sides against the camps you referred to and against schools, against the population? He told me that was the 13th of July, 08. Because we were in Paris, that's why I remember. He said, no, you will see. Other applications will follow. Other applications will follow. That is one. Two, the situation in Sudan is so complicated, as I assume you know. There is the North-South agreement that has to be implemented in the year 2009 up until 2011 with referendums, with elections, and so on. And there is the Abuja agreement between Darfur and the government of Sudan, which has three chapters. One about relations with the neighbors, two about the UN force, three about the development of Darfur by the government and others. Then came this new application, the accusation against Bashir. What we did is the following. The Arab League and the African Union met together, and we decided to do it together and go the whole way together, that we abide by their resolutions and vice versa. And in fact, whatever resolutions adopted by the Arab League, they were adopted in the presence, formal presence, of the African Union and discussed, consulted on what kind of resolution we should adopt. We tried the following: to make use of Article 16 of the Rome system. Article 16 gives the Security Council the authority to request or to demand a year or a certain period of time, I believe it is a year, to try to solve the problem in different ways, and to ask the government or the president of whatever country to apply or to follow a certain line in order to deal with the problem rather than to concentrate on punishing a man, but to produce results. Our fear is that this would interfere with the dates agreed upon to move the north-south equation. So we need to apply this article. Not that we are going to lift the whole weight of the application of Ocampo, but we'll postpone action. During such a year, all of us should cooperate together, stand together, and move with the government of Sudan to move things to a different and a better situation. On that date, 13th of July, in 2 days' time, I was in Khartoum, and I asked the government of Sudan to agree with me on the basis of a paper which was approved. And I brought that paper to the United Nations, Secretary General of the United Nations, and sent it to Europe, etc., and to many countries that are concerned. That paper remains valid. We'll see whether we can, regardless of the 4th of March accusation or a decision by the ICC, whether we can request the Security Council after that, immediately after that, to give us this year, 1 year time to work on the question of Darfur.
I see a lot of hands, and I'm going to go in the order in which I initially saw them. First, this gentleman here, and then the gentleman to his right, please.
Ibrahim Hussein. I am an Egyptian American living here in Washington, D.C., and I present myself, nobody else. I'd like to say, Dr. Amr Musa, thank you for your and the Arab League role in the Arabesque. It is a tremendous program until the middle of March. In here in Washington, D.C. And it's a great way to present the Arab culture and for art. It's just a terrific program. I'd like to ask a question about the Israeli election, and in particular, what this means for moderate Arab states and groups.
Shukran, Ibrahim B. Let me answer the two questions. First, Arabesque. Second, Israeli elections. First, Arabesque. Second, Netanyahu. Okay? First, Arabesque. You know how much we suffered because of this theory, so-called clash of civilizations, which was meant clash between the West and Islam, which was meant, more precisely, clash between the West and the Arab world. The propaganda, including our cousins and etc., so many of them, concentrated on those people there. The culture is a culture of violence. The culture is the culture of hate, etc., etc. We were amazed that some people heard that and believed that. This is the age of globalization. The internet is there. The Quran is there on the net. The interpretations, the literature is all there, not only in Arabic, but in English and in many other. But the propaganda, poisonous propaganda, was succeeded in humiliating a certain culture, if a culture is based on violence, on bloodshed, etc. I understand that reasonable people would say, yes, of course, every culture, every country, etc., they have their bad side, they have their criminals, they have their this and that, or terrorists. Yeah? But you can't describe or insult a whole culture of over a billion and a half, one-fifth of the world population. You cannot say that all of them are criminals. So the Arab League took the initiative, in fact, before any other organization. I called 100 Arab and Muslim scholars, discussed so many things back in 2002, and decided to go it through culture, not policies to say no and say no. You think we are criminals, you are the criminals, etc. That doesn't pay. So we went to Frankfurt with the book, the book fair, the international book fair over there, which invited the Arab book to be the guest of honor back in 2004. We went there with us troops from Lebanon, from Tunisia, and from Egypt. They played in the streets, in the theaters, and it was a big success. Everybody's talking about the Arabs from the prism of a different prism, books, literature, addresses, history, and so on. Ever since, we attend the book fairs, London, and next April in New York, the Arab book is again has a prominent role. But that is the book, literature. We want the others. Here came the Kennedy Center with their initiative, because they do that on annual basis with one country or one culture, with Japan, with China, with India, etc. So we suggested that the Arab world as one. We have one culture, no question about that, but with a variety of facets. Those who attended the first day or the second day or attend for the next 3 weeks will enjoy a different performance, different performances, but they will discover the line that links them all. So I was sitting, listening to the Moroccans with their music, and the Syrians, the young boys and girls, with their songs, and the Omanis with their new performance, very impressive, and with the Egyptian, Ahdaf Swift, reading the from the poems of famous man. This is the way that we are trying to tell you that we are here and we can have one language together. As for the fringes in your society, as in our society, let us isolate them. That's number one. On Mr. Netanyahu, then. And I won't let this go. Is the time, Anna? Time's out?
We have a little more time, and I'm sure we'd all be interested in hearing what you think about Netanyahu.
Okay. Look, we had the government of Kadima for the last 3 years. And you see the result. More settlements, meaningless negotiations, and massacre in Gaza. So what would Netanyahu do more than that? If he wants to do the extreme, not to negotiate, we have negotiated to no avail. To hit Gaza again or hit another, they did it. So if Netanyahu is to form the government, so be it. We don't have to shed tears because another government or another party. We have seen the other party and how the motto was procrastinate. At least Netanyahu will say no from the very first beginning. We are not going to discover the no on the 31st of December, after the full year will have elapsed.
So in the interest of time, because I know you have to get to the airport, I'm going to bundle three questions, and I'm going to ask you first, and then the gentleman here. And Barry, I saw your hand up. Do you want to ask a question as well?
Sure.
Okay. So let's take those three, and then you choose among them as you wish.
I choose one of them. That's good.
You can answer all or none.
Mohammed Shinnah, Voice of America. In your meeting with the American officials, what did you ask of the Obama administration with regard to the Arab Initiative and ways to have better relations between the United States and the Arab world?
In short, I assured them, and I'm going to assure everybody, that the Arab Initiative remains on the table. And since it remains on the table, they have to deal with it. But our position is that it remains on the table, but it shall not remain forever.
Yes, please.
Mohammed Al-Minshawi.
The same. Your name is Mohammed Al-Minshawi, too?
No.
You are Chinawi, is Minshawi. Okay.
Yeah. Editor-in-chief of Takrir Washington and new Egyptian daily newspaper, Ashrook. President Obama missed three golden opportunities to mention a word about democracy in the Middle East in his inauguration and in that Al Arabiya TV interview and last night. Do you think or do you feel there is a shift in Washington about this issue? And will ever the Arab League have a policy toward more democratic states that they represent? Will ever we have an initiative from the General Secretary,
Mohammed,
for more democracy in the region?
The first part of your question again, please. I didn't get the first part.
President Obama missed three opportunities to mention democracy.
Three opportunities? Missed.
Missed three opportunities, okay, to mention a word about democracy or human rights in the Arab world, in his inauguration, in the TV with Arabia, and last night. Do you feel there's a shift in the administration towards this issue? And will ever the Arab League have a policy toward more democratic states that they represent?
Mohammed, you are an American citizen?
Egyptian American.
You are an American citizen?
Yes.
So ask President Obama. Don't ask me. You have all the right, according to the democratic system, to express your views to the president. After.
What's your view?
My view comes in answering the second part of his question. Yes, indeed. You know, we are all, and we have to work for democracy in the Middle East. And we, the Arab League, since you are asking me as the Arab League, we moved in Tunis, in the summit of Tunis in 2004, a very important document about democracy, the respect of human rights, transparency, economic development, rights of women, children, education, and it is a very, very important document, basic document. 2004, adopted in Tunis. And we are working on that now. A, we went to Kuwait with a summit on economic and social development. B, all elections in the Arab world are being supervised mainly by the Arab League. The recent one was in Iraq. Next one is in Algeria. Before that, in Palestine, and so on. The democratic approach in the Middle East is a sound one and necessary. But look what happened, which caused a setback to this demarche. When the Palestinians decided or believed what they were told, that go ahead, elections, be democratic. So they went ahead, elections, became democratic, Hamas won. In half an hour, a statement came, we will cut all aid, finish all cooperation, etc. So the call for democracy, which was very much respected, was very much upset by the reception of the democratic forces in the world of the result of the first real democratic elections that was supervised by President Carter, by the European Union, and by us.
Barry.
Could we go back, please, to basically...
Barry
Schwartz, Associated Press. Could we go back, please, to where we started? Your expression of delight that Obama's president. You spoke highly of Mitchell, but you spoke a lot of objectives like ending settlements. What specifically, and of course he speaks of change, what specifically, if anything, has President Obama said that gives you reason to believe policy, which I suppose you think was too pro-Israel under Bush, that policy has changed? What is it what has he said? What has he done?
Good question. Yes, if we judge by what was said and by statements, etc., you would not necessarily find specific words as to what is going to be done. The policy is not yet pronounced. But I took the appointment, the selection of George Mitchell, as a desire to reinstate a policy of honest brokership.
Do you have time, Mr. Secretary General, for a couple more questions? We could take 5 more minutes? Good. Okay. I want to go in the back and let me, the young lady here, and then you after, please.
From Blair Mersinger from the U.S. Department of Energy. I'm curious as to what you see are the biggest energy policy challenges for the countries in the Arab League, and both with regards to fossil fuels and alternative and renewable energy, and how you plan to address them. Thank you.
Thank you. We are new at this field, But we have to join the crowd, and you have to join all the institutions now and the activities pertaining all those to for all those new issues. And we are getting ready. We are rebuilding our institution in order to bring in experts so that we participate in the discussions and also benefit from the results. Thank you very much for raising this question. This allows me to reintroduce the Arab League. The Arab League is not an organization to discuss only the Palestinian question. The Arab League is a regional organization that has to do with all aspects of regional life, from economic to social, to cultural, as we have seen, and to cater to the new issues that are on the table today. And we are very, very active, in fact, within the region, about that, in cooperation with the FAO, with the cooperation with the ILO, with the cooperation with the WHO, the United Nations, the Environmental Program, the UNDP. So thank you very much for giving me that that opportunity. It was not on my mind to talk about that.
The gentleman, yes, stand rising there. Yes, please. The gentleman actually behind you.
Saifuddin Abdulrahman, advisor to the Vice President of Iraq, but I'm here on personal leave, so representing myself. I wonder if, Mr. Secretary General, you could address the recent changes, or if you see any, towards Iraq by members of the Arab League. There has been some coldness in the past, and I wonder if you could address now things developing in the way that they're developing, how you see the changes by some of the Arab League states towards Iraq. Thank you.
I believe you know that the Arab League itself had a representative in Baghdad quite some time, 2005, 2 years after the invasion. And the Arab countries just went away because of the security situation. Egypt lost an ambassador. Emirates, Algeria lost 2 members. Emirates lost 1 member, if I recall correctly. So it was the call, but from a humanitarian point of view, the families refused to go. So they withdrew. Now the decision has been taken to get back the missions will have to go back to Baghdad, with the amelioration of the security situation. So expect that in the next few months, the presence of the Arab embassies is not the Arab presence, because Iraq is an Arab country itself. So we are talking about the presence of the Arab embassies. Expect that in the next few months to redress the situation again.
I'm going to take 2 final questions. The gentleman who rose before, and then you, sir, here in the third row, with apologies to others, but we're already, I'm afraid, over our time limit. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary General. It's an honor and privilege to have you in Washington, D.C. My question is again about...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Radwan Masmoudi. I'm with the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. My question is about political reforms, and specifically, what is the Arab League planning to do or doing to try to support political reforms in the Arab world? And also about elections. You mentioned that you're going to have observers in the upcoming elections in various countries. Will you be in a position to be critical if there are violations during those elections?
Yes, we issue reports after every election, and the reports are being available for everybody. We say we mention the positive and the negative points to the best of our ability.
Yes, sir.
My name is Tamam Al-Barazi from Al-Watan Al-Arabi magazine. First of all, I want to ask you, Mr. Ignatius, since you mentioned Recep Erdogan, did you regret that you did not give him his 5 minutes? And secondly, Mr. Your Excellency Amr Musa, that there are a lot of criticism for you in the Arab world, why you did not walk out with him. And even Al Jazeera asked for your resignation. So what's happening here?
Very good question. I leave it for David to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. My recollection is that the Prime Minister Erdogan asked for 1 minute, and that I did give it to him. We were 15 minutes over the scheduled end of the session.
Because of Perez.
Well, you know, everybody had talked longer than the allotted time. I wish we'd had more time. It was an intense debate, and I was... I meant, again, let me say at this forum what I've said in others, that I intended no disrespect to the Prime Minister of Turkey, whose efforts as a mediator I admire and I think are important. And do you want to answer
that? Yeah, I just want to add one thing to satisfy our colleague there. Mr. Erdogan withdrew because of dispute between him and David. So why should I withdraw too? It was not a protest against Perez, because we were there for over 1 hour. We were talking, he was talking, we disapproved of everything he said. Exaggerations, and in my opinion, it was one of the worst performances of Perez. Repeating himself, exaggerating, etc., shouting. I found that the best thing is what I have seen from Perez for the first time. He's very eloquent. This time, he was... kind of agitated, very much agitated. When the Prime Minister of Turkey wanted to answer, and I wanted to answer too, because there were a lot of things that should have been answered, there was no time. And I know how the rules are working. Prime Minister of Turkey was reminded by the moderator more than once that that's enough. At a certain moment, both of them were talking. So there was total confusion, which angered Recep Tayyip Erdogan. As the Prime Minister of Turkey, he should have been treated in a different way, given 10 minutes, 15 minutes, since I cannot claim that I am a Prime Minister and insist also on more 15 minutes. So I just stayed where I am, talking to the Secretary General of the United Nations.
I think that's enough on that subject, probably. let me, on behalf of all of us, thank Secretary General Musa for a very useful and frank tour d'horizon, as we say, of the issues we're all thinking about. Thank you so much, Mr. Secretary General, for joining
us.